The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming to CBF Legal, and if today's your first time with us, that is wonderful. I hope you enjoy the morning. Our speaker today, our regular speaker, Ian Powell, is going to be addressing the topic, is Jesus serious with his promises about prayer? I'm going to, inside your program, just read a few of the sentences that are printed, and then I'll hand over to Ian. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. And Jesus answered them, Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, Be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive, if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also, who is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses.
Well, good morning. Now, we're looking at this question of prayer. I remember when I was working at a church at Barney's Broadway, there was a young man, fine young man, I'm still in touch with, and he was madly in love with his best friend. And this relationship had gone on for many years. He would, they'd be friends. He would, his emotions would take over. He would talk to her about that. The friendship would be off. They would rebuild the friendship. And he, this was going on for years. And I said to him, mate, you have to just burn this thing. It's going to kill you. You're going to wake up at the age of 40 and you're going to have missed life. I said, God has never promised you this woman. He hasn't given you a promise. But he felt in his heart that the promises of God about answered prayer, etc., meant he should pursue it. I thought he shouldn't. So when I spoke at his wedding, I got the pleasure of saying, well, here's the thing I never thought would happen. Because I really didn't. I thought he was wasting his life. But his persistence was because as he had drawn near to God in prayer, he felt that the promises about prayer and this gal came together. So we're going to sort of draw into the awkwardness of the dead fig tree what ought to be a joyful area for those who are Christians, but is problematic for Christians and for those who aren't yet Christian, the question of prayer. And particularly it's awkward in the context of Jesus in prayer, because he makes, I think, the most outrageous promises about prayer that you'll find anywhere. How does it work? Well, just in terms of background, though, as you can see from what's ahead, or what was just ahead of the passage that was read, Jesus goes up to a fig tree. This is recorded for us in verse 13. He sees a tree. It's full of leaf. It's not the season for figs, Mark tells us, though. He goes over to see if there's anything to eat there. There's not. He curses it. Well, that's the word that Peter uses. Jesus doesn't use that word. Mark doesn't use it. Peter calls it a curse. That is, he speaks badly to the tree, and the tree, as you heard when they come back later on, is dead. Now, last week I tried to do what you should always do at the Bible. I'm writing to having a conversation with a guy, I presume he's an atheist, I don't know him, but he's certainly not a believer, and he was, I made the statement, you can prove anything from the Bible, a statement that I've spent years and years fighting against. I said, so the Bible clearly says there is no God, and so clearly the Bible's full of contradictions, but many of you will know the context of that statement is Psalm 14, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. So if you want to deliberately misunderstand the Bible or accidentally misunderstand Jesus, simply don't put what he says in context. By the way, I'm not having a go at people who don't believe in God at that point. I'm just saying you can actually say the Bible says there is no God. But of course, it's not saying that at all when you read it in context. It's actually saying the opposite. So the question always is to put words in context. And we looked last week that from Mark chapter 11, which is, you can look at the top verse there, you've got Jesus entering Jerusalem for the first time in Mark's Gospel. It's recorded that he hits Jerusalem. And what you've got is that Jerusalem, in the way that Jesus speaks of it in Mark's Gospel, is all about the temple. So verse 11, Jesus entered Jerusalem and came to the temple. Verse 15, in smaller print, they came to Jerusalem and he entered the temple. In Jesus' mind and Mark's mind, Jerusalem is the temple. It's the palace of God. It's the place where man and God can meet. And this whole thing is a clash between the guys who run that temple and Jesus. Or to put it another way, in a way that Jesus hints at a few times, it's a clash between the physical temple, which is presently corrupt, and the remake of the temple, which is Jesus and his people. It's a sort of a clash between the walking temple and the stone temple. And in the end, the tree that dies is like the temple that's soon to be destroyed. Many of you have been to Jerusalem and you've seen the flat top of the mountain. All that's left is the foundation stone. One of the great wonders of the world, the temple was. It was a gorgeous building full of very devout and religious activity. It all came to nothing. It all died. And Jesus says it's because of his word. What he does to the fig tree, which we looked at, is often a representation of Israel, is an acted parable of the other acted parable, which is the turning up of the tables and the throwing of everything around, which is all pointing to the ultimate destruction of God's own temple, God's own palace, God's own house. That's the context of it. And one word of Jesus changes everything. So when we come back to this, it's kind of nice because people are very sensitive about the fig tree, the poor, unsuspecting fig tree. Happy to eat celery and all sorts of other things, but that particular tree, we've got all sorts of sensitivities about. You'd be glad to know that Jesus doesn't only teach one important lesson for us through the fig tree, but he goes on to have a second lesson. So this dead fig tree, you know, it's playing. The wood's being used for two things at least. And this is the only teaching that Jesus gives in Mark's Gospel on the question of prayer. And it grows out of the dead fig tree. So verse 20. This is day 3. So this is Tuesday. On the Sunday he enters in verse 11. On the Monday he cleans out the temple. On the Tuesday, we're day 3. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. Peter remembered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." Now, Peter seems surprised. We don't know what Peter expected would happen. I think that's fair enough. All Jesus says to the fig tree is, "No one's going to eat fruit from you again." It could just be assumed that he's making a horticultural analysis. That's so dodgy is this tree, so much of an exhibitionist with its fine leaves, which normally with the fig tree comes after the fruit. So it's not the time for fruit in the fig season, but normally the fig tree has fruit first, then leaves. So if you see leaves, you should be able to find fruit. That's how it works. But whether or not Peter just thought Jesus was saying, as it is today, so it will be forever, that the present situation is going to be into sort of perpetuitude, is that how the word goes? In the long term. But Peter is surprised that the tree is dead. 24 hours and the thing's dead, down to the roots. So Peter knows enough to know this is unusual. This is not just an ordinary happening. So he's shocked that the tree is, that the result of Jesus' words is this. Well, it's not quite instantaneous, is it, the death? Because it's not as if Jesus says, "No one will eat fruit from you again," and it dies there in front of their eyes. It's not like his healing miracles where people get healed there. This one destructive miracle of Jesus takes 24 hours. Quite slow, really. But Peter is surprised, and then Jesus takes this as this is a moment to teach about God's power and ability to intervene in human history. Verse 22 goes to the heart of the matter. We're 2b for those who like following the notes. Jesus answered them, "Have faith in God." Now this seems like a fairly dud statement, really. It's a statement of the obvious. Although in our culture it needs to be said, what Jesus is not saying is have faith. In our culture there's a tendency to speak sometimes as if faith in and of itself is a good thing. That's not a view the Bible shares. To speak about having faith often means to be optimistic. Jesus advises you not to have faith in certain things and people. Faith in and of itself is entirely neutral. The question is, who or what you have your faith in. And what Jesus is saying is, have your faith in God. Put your trust in God. Everyone has faith of some sort. Everyone trusts someone. So I think I may have shared with you the other day, a friend of mine, we went and saw that Freud's last session, which is the imaginary meeting of C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud in London as Freud is dying of cancer. And if you're really mad keen on Freud, you'll think Freud doesn't get a good time. If you're really mad keen on C.S. Lewis, you'll think C.S. Lewis doesn't get a good time. I think it's a pretty fair bout between these two heavyweights. But I took one of my friends who's infatuated with Freud. In fact, every time we've met for the last few years, he always quotes something from Freud. So I thought, well, I'd give him a chance to hear C.S. Lewis. But my wife said, I'd heard a lot of C.S. Lewis's arguments before. And that's because Lewis often steals my best thoughts, really. I'm going to sue him when I see him. But my friend said, you know, he speaks of me as a man of faith. But my friend is just as much as a man of faith as I am. He just has his faith in other things and other people. For me, his faith in Freud is extraordinary, since so much of Freud's work has been rightly undermined. He's a genius. But what Jesus is saying is, keep your faith, put your faith in God. They seem to be looking at him going, wow, Jesus, look, you said this and the trees died. He says, put your faith in God. It's kind of the reverse of what he does in John 14, where Jesus says, you believe in God, believe also in me. He seems to bounce you around between trusting him and trusting his Father. So he takes us to the heart. This is, of course, the heart of the question. Right back to Genesis chapter 2 and 3, the question for humankind is, who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust yourself? Are you going to trust someone else? You will trust others in various capacities. The call of the Bible is for us to be people who trust that which is trustworthy. Jesus thinks that's God. Put your faith in God. Then he engages in a great hyperbole. Verse 23, truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, presumably talking about the Mount of Olives that was right there and obvious, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, that's presumably the Dead Sea. If you're on the Mount of Olives, you can see the Dead Sea. Presumably that's what he's saying. Whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and doesn't doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. This is not Jesus' advice on excavation work or landscape gardening. You know, you're out gardening and, my goodness, that rock looks big. I'll pray. It could be, if you want to take it that way. Mountains in the Bible and now are the constant picture of that which is big and immovable and solid. And I don't know where the proverb comes from, but that thing I've heard from my grandmother since I was a kid, the mountain won't come to Muhammad, so Muhammad needs to go to the mountain. I have no idea what the origin of that. But you know that idea. The mountains don't come to you. You want to see a mountain? Everest isn't coming to Camperdown anytime soon. If I want to see Everest, I have to go to the mountain. So Jesus picks this, the biggest, most solid, most immovable thing, and says, "You think the fig tree's impressive? Mountains can be moved." Now, I think it's fair to say, this is not avoiding the issue, this is a hyperbole. But as C.S. Lewis says in the article that I'm offering to you, he says, hyperboles are speaking about something real. So, when something happens, and you might say, his heart is broken, if you just mean by that he's a little bit sad, you know, I got a $250 fine for standing in a bus zone. By the way, be careful, they've got a new way of finding you. I was actually in the car. I'm an old bus conductor. There's no way I'd get in the way of buses. But I was standing there waiting to pick up my very sick daughter that I'm going to write to the council. I've got nothing better to do. So, you know, if I said to you, my heart is broken because of that fine, you would rightly say, what an old windbag he is. Your heart is not broken. You might be moderately unhappy. But if you say the heart is broken, you'd only... It's a hyperbole. No one's heart is ever broken. And when Jesus says mountains will be thrown into the sea, it's a hyperbole, but it means something. Jesus is exaggerating to make a very big point. He's trying to wake us up to something. And Jesus does this repeatedly in the area of prayer, which is why it's so awkward. So there are two other verses there where Jesus does a similar sort of hyperbole. Matthew 17, verse 20. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, and we talked about mustard seeds a few weeks ago, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move. Nothing will be impossible for you. Luke 17. The apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. Jesus replied, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Now, at this point, Jesus has not lost his faith in the power of prayer, that he used to say mountains to the sea, but now it's just mulberry trees to the sea. They're both hyperboles. They're both saying that there's a mountain in front of them, the Mount of Olives, as they go out of Jerusalem. There's a mulberry bush beside them, so he says this mulberry bush. Jesus is saying big, powerful things happen when his disciples pray. You think, and you put a little caveat in there. You said his disciples. Well, of course, that's who he's talking to. Right? He doesn't throw this. There are certain promises he throws out to all people. Whoever believes in me, I'll no ways cast out. Those sorts of promises. But there are other promises that are said exclusively to people who've joined the kingdom, who've joined the family. So Jesus is saying, well, what is he saying? It seems that he's saying, if you look at the words, Jesus is saying, pick something big that's in the way. Pray about it confidently. It'll be done for you. Not by you, but for you. It seems to be almost a blank check, does it not? That Jesus is offering to his people. But this, as you know, can be a terrifying prospect. If you've watched that great theological movie, Bruce Almighty, which, by the way, is not a terribly bad movie to watch, actually. It did quite well, and it's quite, you know, quite a good movie. It's got some good actors in it. Where, it, you know, he deals with this very selfish newsreader is given the power to do anything except remove freedom of the will. And it's this interesting exploration. But last night I watched a downloader from iTunes, a source of much time wasting, an episode from The Twilight Zone. You remember The Twilight Zone? In the earliest days of it, it used to have this strange music. And then it would say, do not try and change the channel. Do not try and turn your television off. You know, you've lost control. You've entered the Twilight Zone. Now, the one I watched was more recent, so it didn't have quite that ominous tone to it. But it's a series of very clever stories. Whoever was the writer was very clever. But this one is called It's a Good Life. And it's introduced by telling us about this little town in America that has become the only town in the world because a monster is there. And the monster's name is Anthony Freeman. And the monster has removed the entire world except this one little town. And the monster is 6 years old. And the monster's got a cute smile. And the monster is a monster because whatever he wills to happen, happens. And you go to this... He doesn't like singing. You can play music, but you can't sing. And a man gets drunk. I don't want to give the whole story away. But a man gets drunk on his birthday on one of the last 5 bottles of alcohol in the village because the guy has removed the rest of the world and he does some dangerous stuff and he gets turned into something. And it's actually the story of how fearsome it is if someone is omnipotent. Is that what we think Jesus is doing? That he's saying, anything you want, if you're a disciple of mine, just ask for it, believe you've got it, and you've got it. We talked about this last year. I'm not sure if I want even someone as pure and as good and as noble as myself to have that power. Is God at this point actually stepping down from the throne effectively, or making his throne simply a servant of your passions and desires? Or is Jesus doing something a little different? He goes from the hyperbole to verse 24. Which doesn't help the problem in a sense. Jesus says, not some ratbag television evangelist, therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you've received it, and it will be yours. This does feel like a blank check, doesn't it? That Jesus is saying, whatever you ask, well, just trust me, trust God, and it's yours. So you get a whole theology called name it and claim it, right? Whatever you want. And I read some deep and thoughtful websites on this, and it's all about health, wealth, love. It's become, these promises are taken simply to become a thing to make all my troubling desires come true. Although, interestingly, all of this is in the plural when Jesus says it. It's all said to a community of people, which may make some difference to what we think to pray about. But so Jesus gives a hyperbole that means a lot. He then gives a statement of promise. But then in verse 25, is this a condition? Whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also who is in heaven may forgive you for your trespasses. This is the only time in Mark's Gospel when God is referred to as your Heavenly Father. Mark's Gospel has very little teaching, lots of action. He is the only teaching on prayer, and he's the only context in which God is spoken of as our Father who is in heaven. And he says, as he says in a number of places, if you choose to not forgive, do not expect God to forgive you. If you say forgiveness is not for me, I will not live in a universe dominated by forgiveness. And where people need my forgiveness, I will not give it. And I'm aware as I say this that there will be people in this room that have got horror stories of people who have deliberately and repeatedly hurt you. Or sometimes even worse, deliberately and repeatedly hurt people that you love. That's often harder to forgive than what's done to you. Jesus is not saying for those of you who have trouble forgiving, but he's saying if you say, I'm not going to forgive, Jesus says, do not expect God to forgive you if you refuse to give to people what God gives to you. This is clearly a thing that will damage our prayer life. Is this a condition? I think it would be fair enough to say that. Are there other conditions that the Bible puts on prayer? Context is always important. Jesus is not, he's not shouting this out in the temple. He's saying this to the disciples. Well, as C.S. Lewis draws attention to the fact, you've got almost two difficult to reconcile teachings from Jesus in the same Gospels about prayer. So Jesus says this about prayer. In chapter 14, Jesus himself will not pray along this line. He's facing the cross. Many people have died worse deaths than Jesus. No one has feared death as much as Jesus. He's not a Stoic, nor is he a Buddhist. He's terrified by his death. He is sweating great drops of blood, because it's not his death, it's not the nails that concern him. It's what's going to go on between his Father and him. And he talks about this cup. Remember, three times he goes back and falls on his knees and says, oh my Father, all things are possible with you. He knows that God can move mountains. All things are possible with you. Take this cup from me. But not what I will, but what you will. This is the air Jesus breathes. This is what it is to be one of his disciples. This is what it is to be in the kingdom. It's to start to live saying, not my will, but yours be done. In the immediate moral question, where it may be much easier for you if you do your will and his will. To do his will may actually damage you. Or in the larger sort of sovereign questions of how life is working out. Does Jesus fail to pray in the very way that he tells us to pray? Or when we rip this verse out of the context of who's saying it and who he's saying it to as he builds the kingdom of God, are we actually just accidentally doing violence to what Jesus is saying? There do seem to be, I'm not sure if conditions is the right word for it, but there do seem to be prior assumptions that Jesus has when it comes to the question of prayer. It's interesting when you look at the early apostles, they don't take these, you know, two or three verses in Mark and six or seven verses in John and maybe 10 or 12 verses in Luke and build this whole thing about prayer that we can have whatever we damn well want, you know, name it and claim it, particularly if it's for personal satisfaction. James, the brother of Jesus, says very clearly, you do not have because you do not ask, in James 4, and when you ask you don't receive, because you asked to spend it on your own passions. So the early apostles, Peter, James, John, the apostle Paul, when he gets caught up in them, they don't have this view that having the promise of Jesus, we can go and, as it were, move mountains around for our own personal pleasure. But there are a number of other conditions, e.g. in Psalm 66, verse 18. It says, if I cherish iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. But I take it that's all caught up in the your will, not my will be done. So the puzzle there, which I've typed out under number 3, the puzzle and the promise, just as I finish. Is Jesus really asking us to trust God in a way that he doesn't do in Gethsemane? Has he failed to pray in the way that he lies out? Because he doesn't say, take this cup from me and I'm believing you to take it from me. But he says, take this cup from me, but ultimately I don't want my will, I want your will. Or the way in which he models in the Lord's Prayer, where, you know, your kingdom come, your will be done. But these promises mean something. Jesus, I don't want to, I feel as if I've acted like a bomb defusal team here today. These promises are pushing us toward, why does Jesus keep saying it? Why does Jesus always say it twice? Wherever Jesus makes the promises about prayer, he says it twice. You look it up in all of the Gospels. He says it once, he says it twice. Why? He's trying to say, in the same way as when I spoke to the fig tree, God acted. So you are caught up with a Father who is eager to hear your prayers, and you can pray expecting things to happen. The context matters, the overall context, but we're not dealing with a God who is distant. We're not dealing with some God who's made up his own plans and doesn't listen to the requests of his children. The constant push of Jesus is, pray. It will make a huge difference. It will change the world, and it has. Let me give you one of my favourite stories. And this is the sort of area, if you look at the context of the verses I've put there from Matthew 17 and Luke 17, they're all in the context of crucial eternal issues. George Mueller, if you've never read a biography of George Mueller and you're a biography reader, it's worth reading. Delighted in God is one about him. George Mueller ran orphanages through Bristol for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children for decades. And he did it without ever once asking for money. His view was that God is the father of the fatherless. I feel God is urging me to start these orphanages. I will trust him to. And there are just ridiculous stories in his biographies that are accounted by others as well, where one time he was sitting in one of these houses with 300 children, and the matron came and said, Mr. Mueller, we have no food. Sit the children down anyhow and give thanks to God. Apparently, the accounts say that while they're sitting there, thank God for the food, a knock comes on the door from the local baker, who says, I couldn't sleep last night. I felt I should get up and I cooked 3 runs of loaves for your guys. So would they be of use? Yep. And unfortunately for the local milk deliverer, his cart broke down outside it, and he came and said, it's going to go off anyhow, can you use it? Now, that was one of the more extremes, I think, the idea of sitting children down and saying thanks, but that was his understanding that God would hear and answer his prayers. When he became a Christian, he was like lots of Germans, he was a young drunk. I think he missed his mother's funeral because he was drunk. I say that because a lot of my heroes are German, so if you're German, we'll talk about that later. He began to pray for 5 of his friends. Within 1 year, one of them had become a Christian. Within 10 years of praying, another 2 had become Christian. 25 years, the 4th became a Christian. He died having been a Christian for 52 years, and within about 12 months of his death, his last friend was saved. Prayer, what God is saying is, Jesus is saying, ask. God has 2 speeds. Very slowly and immediately. So the tree doesn't die the moment Jesus says that, but it's as good as dead. And God, what Jesus is saying is here, ask and you will receive. I'll be silent so you can ask. Not.
Ja, vielen Dank, Ian, für deinen Vortrag heute Morgen. Und,
auf Wiedersehen.
Yeah. Any questions, I'll collect those now.
Peter von Trapp.
Thank you. I've heard a new phrase, I think it's called casual racism. Which is, even comments by like that, I think, you know, friendly comments about Germans, even though a number of my great heroes are Germans. Apparently that's called casual racism, which is still as wicked as enslaving people. Does this mean that there is justification for the destruction of an innocent fig tree? Yes. I can do it, he flippin' likes the trees. Actually, he can do it, he likes the people too. But we don't like to think about that. The thing is, I like what he likes to do with people, and I like what he likes to do with trees. But I'm not going to... see me after if that was too cabby an answer. Mark 11:23. Whoever... I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea. Supposed to be a promise not limited to the disciples, even if Luke 17, etc., is limited. Yes, I think the trouble with when you throw the door open, we have the church I go to, the minister was speaking about a command where the Bible says everything. And he said, that means everything. And I wrote a question in saying, you don't mean everything, do you? I mean, because you can often, the Bible, as we will often do, will say everything, not meaning everything. So the Bible will say, all have sinned. There is no one that is righteous, no, not one, always knowing that Jesus didn't. So the way that you make a very strong point is often to use this universal language. And I don't think it's carelessness or game playing. What Jesus is saying is... He's trying to say it's not just the priests, it's not just the super spirituals, but whoever, right, prays. Well, I just think in the end you need to bring Jesus' words back into their context. If you take them out of their context, you finish up with the Bible that says that there is no God. And Jesus is talking to the disciples. It's very clear, as this questioner said in Luke 17, it's crystal clear to the disciples. He's talking to the disciples. I think in the end, you could, if you want to argue, it's whoever. So I was chatting to my... youngest daughter yesterday, who's been sick for 3 years, and she's getting kind of desperate. Not a great ad for doctors, the way that she's been misdiagnosed and overlooked, blah, 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 blah. But she's now going to a healing service. I asked if I could mention this. She's now going to the healing service at the cathedral. She feels bad about asking God for stuff when she herself is not a paid-up follower. I said, I think with Jesus you can still just come as you are and ask. So there's no doubt that, in fact, when, I'm reading this separately, when the temple is built and Solomon prays this magnificent prayer about how God may use the temple, it's all about prayer, it's not about sacrifice, interestingly. And it talks about when the Gentiles, those who don't know you, come and pray, will you hear from heaven, answer their prayer so that they may know that you are God. The house of prayer, the temple's supposed to be, and it's open to all. It's expected it will be for the people of God. But it's also, God is generous and will allow others in to pray. This is the significance, I think, is this. If you read some commentaries, and my goodness, some commentators, they're clever but silly sometimes. They just speak as if this stuff about prayer, with Mark had this thing about prayer, well, we're all left, I'll slap it on us. No, no, he's just gone and destroyed the house of prayer. He's just on a parable saying, this place is going down. It is then replaced with the community of prayer. It's beautifully linked, the symbol of the destruction of the temple and Jesus' teaching about prayer, because this is the new people of God. It's the new temple. It's a temple of prayer. It's a temple of forgiveness. That's the mark of the Christian community. If this is a hyperbole, what are the realistic limits to what prayers God might answer in the way that we ask him to? I think the basic limits are your will, not mine, be done. Which, for those who don't trust God, I'm not using that in the year, but those who are struggling with trusting God may seem like a cop-out. It's frankly not. I don't want God to do whatever I ask. I do at times when I get a bit petulant, but I understand that I don't understand. God will not, he's a father who's saying, come and ask me. I say to Eloise, you know, any time you want help, ring me. Any time you need anything, ring me. Now, of course there are times that I won't be able to help, but I want her to know, don't ever not come and ask. And that's what I think God is saying. Our tendency is not to go. So James says, you don't have because you don't ask. There's a whole series. So one of the things I'm planning on doing is starting one of those prayer diaries. You know what those things are? I've never kept one, but I've had friends who have. You write down key things you're praying about with dates and come back every so often and see how many of them God answers. It's quite shocking when my friends have done it. that you ask and this happens and you can just forget it's come as an answer. I don't think there's any limit to what you should ask for. Ian. Not a question but for your information. Good. On the 2011 constructed Dr. Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. is inscribed, "From a mountain of despair, a stone of hope." Hyperbole used as inspiration. Okay. Well, I think that's probably helpful. I think we do. We need to keep taking hyperbole. I have a friend who thinks that I don't take the Bible seriously because I don't personally take Genesis, and I know some of you do. I don't take Genesis 1, 2, and 3 literally. He keeps saying to me, "I take it seriously." And I say, "No, I might be wrong, you might be wrong. I take it just as seriously as you do. The question is to work out what's it trying to do." The way to take literature seriously is not always to take it literally. Sometimes if you take it literally, you've not taken it seriously. And I think the thing with Jesus is to recognize, he's saying, you can trust God. Which God? The God who intervenes in the fig tree. The God who hears prayers and answers them. So I think what Jesus is saying in this passage is, for goodness sake, pray. Stop worrying, etc. And I'm not much of a worrier, but when I first became a Christian, I stuck two things up on the wall in my wardrobe. One was Psalm 15, and the other one was, "Why pray when you can worry?" I must have been worried about something. But I, you know, my wife and I are waiting on an important sort of appointment she's hoping to get as a graduate nurse. And she's struggling with the waiting and the worrying, you know. And we keep joking about it. I mean, why would you trust God? I mean, he's only sent his son to die for us. Blah, 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 you know. Much better to spend our time worrying. So I think Jesus is saying, you know, pray and expect that God will answer one way or the other.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.